Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And tonight, I'm really, really honored and really excited to be interviewing Shoshana Kaufman, who is almost a doctor. She graduates on May 13th. And I told her that I'm going to have to call her on May 13th to be one of the first people to call her doctor. So before I get into her amazing story, I'm going to say, please, if there's a topic you want to hear, if you have comments on talks I've done, if you know someone you want to be interviewed, if you yourself want to be interviewed, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H at joma.org. So Shoshana Kaufman was raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she attended a large urban public high school and graduated as valedictorian. She went on to earn her bachelor's in psychobiology from Yale University. While at Yale, she became a certified sexual assault counselor, volunteered extensively at AIDS Project New Haven, and worked in the Yale New Haven Pediatric Psychiatric Inpatient Unit. She received honors for her senior thesis, Differences in Healthcare Utilization Among HIV-Positive Women, the Influence of Sociodemographic Factors, Exposure Category, and Attitudes Towards the Healthcare System. During her junior year, her father passed away in an accident which led her to take a spiritual journey to Israel after graduation. Over the next few years, she became frum and started a family, raising five children in the process. She hosted up to 20 guests each week for Shabbos and Yontif meals. She organized meals and hosted Shever Brachas for hundreds of people in her community. When her friend's child was accepted to be evaluated at the National Institute of Health due to her having three seemingly unrelated life-threatening diagnoses simultaneously, she drove from Cleveland to Bethesda multiple times to be by her friend's side through the evaluations and treatments. She was deeply inspired by the care shown to her friend's daughter by Dr. Rafaela T. Goldbach-Mansky, MD, MHS, Senior Investigator Chief, Translational Autoinflammatory Diseases Section at the National Institutes of Health. As her children were getting older and leaving the house, her friend encouraged her to finally pursue her original dream to become a physician. After not having been in a classroom for over 30 years, she managed to get in the 94th percentile on the MCATs. She will graduate May 13th from Ohio University's Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine and will begin a residency in family medicine at Metro Health Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio. The program is known for its intensity as it serves primarily the poor, uninsured, and prison inmates. She is enthusiastic about this opportunity and looks forward to serving her patients with compassion and expertise. Welcome, Shoshana. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor.
Oh, the honor is mine. I remember it wasn't that long ago where you basically went viral on social media when you got accepted to your residency and you shared it and you put a whole beautiful post that was so inspiring to people, I think, in the medical field and not in the medical field. So I'm really excited to hear your story from the beginning. So I'm going to let you just start with maybe where you were in college. Let's start there. When you were pre-med, your classic Ivy League pre-med.
Okay. So I am going to back up a little bit, if that's okay. My mom said that when I was little, I don't know if this is true, she said that she used to whisper to me when I was sleeping, "You are going to be a doctor." So it could have started before college.
So she gets all the credit then.
Yeah. So I was pre-med in college at Yale, and I was majoring in psychology and biology. I was having a lot of fun. We were partying. We were just so high on life at being at this incredible school. And I think that we didn't really appreciate we felt excited and happy, but I don't think we realized what an incredible education we had at our fingertips. And then when my father died in an accident my junior year, and my whole world fell apart. Part of what happened in the months and years that followed was this feeling that any day could be the last day. And I needed to make every single day count. I felt like when I would be with my mom and my sister after my dad died, you know, when you have two mirrors facing each other and the image goes on and on and on, mm-hmm. looking at them into their eyes, and I was in so much pain and they were in so much pain. It was just unbearable to be with them. And I felt so alone at a time when I needed to be supported. And that was when I started reaching out more Jewishly. I had grown up secularly. My mom did a lot of Jewish stuff. My mom really grew up with almost no Judaism. And she taught herself to read Hebrew. We started doing like Shabbat dinners. She did a Seder every year. We lived in Concord, Massachusetts, which is the WASPiest city in the United States of America. We were probably the only Jews at that time. And my mom built a sukkah on the front lawn. And the police were called. So she definitely was a pioneer and started my sister and I on this quest of wanting to be more Jewish, more connected. So I took a year off from school. When I went back to school, I was taking all advanced biology classes and I was getting straight A's. It was a very different experience than my first 2 years in school. I was extremely disciplined and very much engaged and devoted to doing well. I took the MCATs. I did well on the MCATs. At some point, I just felt like the more I learned about Judaism, the more that I wanted. I was talking to the chaplain at Yale, and he said to me at a certain point, I can't give you more than what I've given you. You have to go to Israel. You need to go to seminary. And I said, I can't. I'm going to medical school. And then at a certain point, I was like, I have to go to seminary. And I couldn't imagine I had done so much work on myself and being self-disciplined and being less self-centered. I couldn't imagine going to medical school and the level of focus and intensity that it required. And I had this idea of the kind of mother I wanted to be. I couldn't imagine doing that and being that mother. I see all these like superstar moms on, these firm women with a lot of kids and in surgery and, you know, doing these incredible, Eliana, you know, doing OBGYN, the incredible women. I couldn't imagine myself doing that. And I decided to go to Israel and not to go to medical school. And I became from, I got married, I had five crazy kids in 8 years, like bam, bam, bam. And I just assumed I could never go back. I'm actually can't believe I'm having this conversation right now.
I can't believe it either.
It's surreal to me. I feel like I'm in a dream, honestly.
It's really interesting because I also interviewed Bracha Goetz. Do you know who Bracha Goetz is?
She's not sure.
A children's book author, and she had a very similar trajectory. She was at Harvard and she was pre-med and she got into med school and she dropped out. And she also grew up without a strong religious background and she left because the whole spiritual growth takes so much out of you. You have to put so much into it. You're right. You could never have been able to do those two things at the same time. You can't compare that to somebody who grew up from and took that as their mother's milk. It wasn't yours.
Yes, that's true. I appreciate that validation.
Yeah. Yeah. So she never went back like you. She's a book author and, you know, she gives in a different, you know, way. I know a number of people who dropped out along the way because it turns out that it really wasn't the right path for them. But your story is so unusual in that it always was. So then what happens?
So as the kids got a little bit older and I got more cleaning help, I started taking care of people in the community. And I did a lot of things that a lot of other people do. I organized a lot of meals for people who were in crisis. You know, people who had had babies, but also more unusual, impossible situations. We started having guests for Shabbos and it became like this thing, like we would have like 10 to 20 people, you know, people with special needs, people, our friends, people who are divorced, people who someone just died, people in financial crisis, someone who just got out of jail. And it was very fancy. It was like sterling and, you know, I had cleaning help. I'm not like some superstar. It was like,
I would disagree, but okay. Keep going, talking.
And like, I know, but people, you know, it is easier when you have cleaning help to do something like this. And I, an iron tablecloths, and people kept saying, you should open a restaurant. Your food is just, I'm like, this is a restaurant. It's just free. and we would do this thing where I would give people at the table blessings and people would like cry. And it was just, it was very powerful. People would come in the kitchen to help and they'd say, you know, this is better than therapy. And we would have Sheva Brachas that were like very elaborate and magnificent. And it was so much fun. It was so much fun. And I got to this point where the kids are getting older and they're, you know, they're going to college, they're going to Israel. They don't need me as much. And I was feeling kind of like I was on Facebook and I was like wasting time and I need to do something. And I was talking to a friend of mine about what could I do. And a lot of people had said I should be a therapist or, you know, I should, I don't remember what it's called. It's something like where you go with old people to their appointments and then you explain to the family what's going on with them medically.
Like a patient advocate.
I was really good at like breaking it down in like layperson's terms and at remembering every single detail.
Which navigator. Why I called the navigator. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is why I could go into medicine also.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah. So, but everything I thought of, I just thought I would be so, I cannot be in that appointment and not be the doctor. Like I would be so jealous to be somebody else in that room. I don't want to be the nurse. And I don't want to be a therapist. I don't want to, if I would sit for 8 hours, I would die. I just can't, I can't. And my friend Dina, well, what do you really want to do? Well, I wanted to be a doctor, but you're going to be a doctor. She interrupts me and shouts it at me. And so I was sort of, I thought it was like funny at first. I still don't believe it. I don't know when I'm going to believe it. We're going on like years now doing this, and here I am. So I started studying for the MCATs, and people, all these people that I had helped that had been hosting for years were so excited. And they started, people were like going shopping, grocery shopping for me, and like helping me with things because they were so excited for me to do this. And it seems kind of funny now, given the last 4 years of medical school, what I have done at home and what I have done in school, that at that point when I was studying for the MCATs, I thought I needed help grocery shopping, but whatever. And I remember at one point somebody saying to me, you know, medical school is a lot harder than the MCATs. And I was like, how could that be? So I used Khan Academy, which is this free online site, and you know, first graders could use it for math. And I used it to prep for the MCATs. And then I took two classes at Cleveland State University because I needed letters of recommendation, biochemistry and cell biology. And again, when I was taking those classes, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so hard.
Wait a second. I just want to go back for just a minute. Your college classes ended 30 years ago, right?
They didn't. So there was a lot of technical prep leading up to this. Like,
right,
can I do this? I live in Cleveland. I have five children. My husband's business is here. I'm not moving.
Right.
Which medical schools are drivable from me? So there was Case Western and there was OU, which is based in Athens, but has a campus in Cleveland. And then there was NeoMed, but that's 45 minutes. So I ended up not even applying there. And I felt, because I'm really good at standardized tests, I felt like I felt totally confident I could get into OU based on their advertised mean MCAT score.
Plus, it sounds like the Orthodox Union, so that's got to be a good omen.
I was overconfident at that point. I mean, you just can't. I mean, imagine, like, I went to Yale, and I was used to being, and I hadn't been, like, in a professional environment. I had just been, like, home with my kids and then my friends, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into, or how
I just have to run back just a little bit. Those classes that you took 30 years ago counted as all your prerequisites, or you had to take a whole bunch
So Case wanted me to repeat my prereqs, and I didn't want to because I felt like I'm already so old. I need to, if I'm going to do this, I need to do this immediately, which was a mistake in retrospect, because I had no idea how hard it was going to be back in school. I should have taken a year and just taken basic classes.
My head had exploded, but keep talking.
So I didn't apply to Case initially. I just applied to, first I was just going to apply to OU, and I was totally confident I can get in. Then I got the day they said, this is a little bit of a cute story. So the day we were getting our MCAT scores, I was in my car outside of Starbucks, and I'm clicking on the links, and the scores come up, and I have like this out of body experience where I'm like shaking and I feel like I can't read what's on the screen. So I called my sister and I gave her my login information so she could tell me what was on the screen. And she starts, Shoshi, you did it. You really did it. because I had gotten 94th percentile.
Crazy.
Like I hadn't been
among pre-meds, by the way, just so people should understand, this is among the most cutthroat, academically sharp people in the country.
These are people who just graduated from Stanford in pre-med who are 24. So, and everyone's like, you should definitely apply to CASE. So I did apply to CASE, but I hadn't done the prereqs. So they didn't, you know, I didn't even listen to them. So obviously they didn't consider me. So when I interviewed at OU, I told them I was going to be their first grandmother.
You were already a grandma by that point?
No, I told them I'm going to be.
Oh, okay.
You know, I thought it was like a cute, funny thing to say.
And then?
And then what part do you want to hear next?
What came next? The whole story. I want to hear every detail.
So I got into OU. Mm-hmm. I was going to do research on infant mortality in Cleveland. And I had started working with somebody who ended up being one of my professors at OU. And then this family in our community went into like really serious crisis, and it was more than a full-time job for the next while. So I didn't do the research job. It was like the last hurrah, like the climax of all the community service we had done prior to that time. So when school started, I had no idea how to access the assignments online. You know, I'm not stupid. I'm not like a person that's afraid of technology, but I had taken the two classes at Cleveland State that were on, you know, at a time when everything's online, and it was not a problem. But I had never, prior to that, everything I had ever done was pen and paper and books. And the first day of school, I went to the learning specialist and told her, I need your help. Like, I need to know how to Excel. And should I use pen and paper? Do people take notes on iPads? What do you think is my best? Oh, whatever works best for you. And every time I went to her, it was whatever works best for you. I never got any help. I think at some point in school started in August. At some point in October, one of my classmates says to me, did you read the assignment? And I said, what assignment? Uh-oh. And she said, this is how you access the assignments. It was grueling, and it was humiliating, and I felt like there would be days I would walk into school and I wouldn't know what day it was or where I was supposed to be. I called my sister at one point and I said, am I getting old? She said, no, it's just a lot to be in medical school at our age.
Also, you hadn't done academics for 30 years.
Right. Right. And I realized also over the last 4 years, a lot of information is conveyed in like friend groups. Like, I remember asking this one person who always seemed to know everything, where did you find such and such, or can you help me with such and such? And he was like, I actually don't know. I just ask so-and-so. Like, there's a lot of people in medical school, well, in the world, I guess. And they get by because they have somebody who knows how to navigate the online or the, there was a number of women who were always saving me. Like I would, there's this one woman, Missy, who I would have no idea what was going on. She would like send me, I'd be like, Missy, I have been looking for an hour for this document. She would just email it to me. She just always saving me.
I mean, this isn't even the academics. This is just opening the door to get
to
the academics. No,
the amount of time that I wasted just trying to find things. Yeah, there was a lot of kind people who helped me and supported me.
Basically, what you're saying is you were on the other side of the tick divide, and that was a barrier.
On the other side of what?
You were on the other side of the tech divide, the generational tech divide.
Yes, I was. And I feel like even embarrassed now to say that because
why? It's just
true. I don't see myself as one of these people who's like afraid of like obviously I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't love learning and love new things. I feel because I thought of myself as a person who like, just show me how I could do it. But there was nobody to show me how, even though I kept asking. You know, it was very piecemeal.
Right. I joke that kids today are born with a chip, a silicon chip embedded in them, right? And that's what I mean by the tech divide. It's just natural. It's like trying to explain how you breathe.
Right.
So that was one whole barrier. What about the learning of this? Like they say that medical school is like drinking from a fire hose.
It was really hard. On the one hand, I could say I still feel really smart. I feel like I can synthesize information really well, and I think my memory is still really good. And I think I see the big picture better than other people. And I certainly see the big picture when I talk to patients in terms of knowing that, you know, you can't recommend that she starts protein shakes. They cost $4 each and she has no money and she took off the day from work to come here for this appointment. So in that sense, I understand more in terms of how hard it is for people to make good choices when they're under stress. But I'm saying intellectually also, I think I see the bigger picture sometimes. But I would get so spun around, like I didn't even know what am I, you know, they would assign these really, really long things to read. And really all you needed was like four pieces of information. And so I spent a lot of time like being spun around and not knowing what to study and being confused instead of actually sitting and studying.
How did that work with your family? Because your family was used to having you full time, and this sounds like more than a full time job.
I think it's more like, how did it work with medical school? I kept trying to hire somebody to like run the house, but there is no such person. I mean, I have no idea how these women do it who have young children. I never found that person. Things are going to be very different when residency starts. Like, I'm not doing anything like fancy, but like, there's always food in the house. Mm-hmm. My kids can always reach me. I'm always available to talk. You know, all the things that your teenage children need, I have been available for. There are things I was able to get help with, like my dad takes my girls to the dentist and to the orthodontist. There were a few times like somebody, you know, my older daughter who's married, like the kids would go to her, or my parents would sleep over, or, but 90% of it, I was still available for. Mm-hmm. You know, we did more Instacart, or we might have more cleaning help, but the basic things of like being available, I have been available for. When my 16-year-old turned 16, I let her get, she's a really good safe driver, thank God. We bought her a car. Like, I never thought I would be a person that would buy a 16-year-old a car. And she's just, you know, she's just, if, when I'm in residency, she could go to the supermarket and buy stuff. She can get stuff for Shabbos pre-made.
And what do your kids think about this? I'm just curious. The ones that are home.
They're, so, it was really, really sweet, especially in the beginning. Now, it's not as dramatic because this has been this way for years. I used to cover my hair like all the time, even at home. And when I started medical school, I would come home and I would take off my sheitel or my scarf like immediately. I just felt like so exhausted. And one of my daughters would come over and like play with my hair and like massage my shoulders. I mean, the relationship like switched. Mm-hmm. They're so proud of me. They like make me like inspirational posters.
It's so cute.
Like you can't achieve the impossible unless you attempt the absurd, and like all the stuff like behind me. This is like I mean, it was never like this before. Where they're encouraging
me. They know that you're happy and they feed on it, right? You inspire them, they inspire you.
They're so excited for me.
Yeah.
Like this kind of thing.
Aww. You are braver and stronger than you ever think, and love more than you know. I can't read all of it.
Like they, you know, the kind of thing that a mom gives a child, that's how they are with me now.
It's like the mirror reflecting back and forth that you mentioned before, right? It's that same mirror, but for the positive.
Right.
Kids know. They know when you're happy. They know when you're not. They know when you're fulfilled, and they know when you're not.
Yeah.
Right? It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I feel like that must be how you knew you were going in the right direction, right? No?
No. I don't think I really, once I started, I didn't feel that I could stop. Mm-hmm. And the more that I was in it, I mean, it's so expensive. And it's so many hours. And there was no stopping once I was doing it. I feel a little bit more confident now. I know in residency it'll soon be dashed, but there is something at the end of fourth year where you start to feel like you know things and you start to have an idea when you're with the patient which direction you want to go or what would make what would be an appropriate plan. I guess something that has been consistent is that patients love me and they respond to my warmth. And I feel like so honored. You know, you ask people these questions, like, who can you, you don't ask people these questions. You ask people such intimate questions and rapid fire, like not in a, like a nice, cute, soft way. Like you just, blah, 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 blah. And then you like start touching their body under their clothes, lie down, sit up, take off your shoes. I mean, every time it is such an honor. And I feel that, you know, I have been like invited into like this intimate space. I feel so honored. That feeling makes me feel like this is, I'm on the right path.
Because it's reinforcing everything you do.
Because a lot of people aren't comfortable in that arena. Even a lot of doctors aren't comfortable, which is, you know, they can be very cold because that's how they're dealing with being in that intimate, that weird intimate place. And people that, you know, I had a standardized patient, like when I had no idea what I was doing. So it turned out she was the mother of this professor that I ended up loving and becoming friends with. And so the professor told me later on, you know, my mom wants you to be her doctor after you finish residency.
Aww.
Just based on, and I was so awkward then, I had no idea of anything. She said, oh, she's going to be great.
Why medicine? Why medicine and not something else?
Because the interface between the body and the soul is so exquisite and mind-boggling. And the details that Hashem lets us see, especially when you get to medical school and you get to the point where in the textbooks in medical school, they say things like, we're not sure how this happened. They acknowledge that they've reached the dead end, that they don't know the next answer or the next why. And it's just the patterns, the systems, the intricacy, the fact that it, you can have somebody who is so sick in front of you and 99% of the systems are working exactly as they're supposed to be working. It's just mind-boggling. And I like to be with people when they're in that place, when they're scared. And I, you know, all this time that I was doing all this community service, it was just because I like working hard and I love taking care of people. And, but there was no expertise. It was just a gift that it's just how I am. I wanted to do it. I know what the story I need to tell you. So I was in the playground with my sister and her two kids. She's a family law attorney. So she gets, you know, when her kids were little, she would get calls when she was with her kids because the type of attorney she is. And she shifts. She goes into attorney mode on this phone call. And I was so jealous. She was an expert in her field. She was poised. She was regal. She knew what the person needed. She had what they needed because of years that she had invested in this specialty. And I wanted that.
But for you, it was medicine.
Yes.
Yeah. I've heard people say that, you know, if you choose to be a doctor, before you choose that, think of anything else you could be. And if that would satisfy you, be that other thing. And what you're saying is nothing else would satisfy me.
Yes,
that was the thing that I needed to do, right?
Yes, it's such a grueling. I haven't even started residency yet, and it's been so grueling.
Right. Residency is known for being more.
Yes. Grueling. Yes.
Right, but you already know that this is what you want to do. This is not, you're not a young, the advantage of being older, right, is you've already lived through, you know, the part where you just might be told to do it, or you just might, you know, have some kind of romantic idea of it, right? You've made a mature decision that this is the only thing that's going to fulfill you.
Yes.
Career-wise.
Yes.
Right.
And so, I'm very excited. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a little bit more positive sometimes than I might have been when I was 25, because I feel so lucky to be able to do this now.
Right. I want to know how you feel your past experiences are going to help you be a better doctor. You've had a lot, so you can pick. Like maybe the most formative ones.
When I was a sexual assault counselor, mm-hmm. in New Haven. This is before cell phones. So you would get the pager for 24 hours. So, you know, you would be out and about and then the pager would go off and you'd have to find a payphone. And, you know, there's cars and people and it's raining and you're at the payphone. And then as soon as the person is on the line with you, everything else would disappear. And it would just be me and her. And the intensity of that moment in time is something that I want. When there's nothing else except you and the patient and the problem at hand. And I had a friend who had a daughter who was very sick. They were living in Israel at the time. And you know, they thought she was normal for the first few years of her life. In retrospect, there were so many signs that the pediatrician, somebody should have picked up on, but nobody did. Like she always was very pale. She always had like really dark circles under her eyes. She always, her hands were always like this. Her knees were always like, she walked like an old woman. But we always just thought of it as just, that's just how she is. Like, I don't know. I wasn't in medicine then. Then she gets a rash. Then she goes to this doctor, this doctor. It turns out she ended up getting she had many strokes. She ended up getting accepted at NIH. And they, for an evaluation and then different experimental treatments. And so they flew her in several times with her mom. And my kids were young then, but I figured out childcare and I drove to Bethesda to be with them. And they're, you know, one of the things I had always revered NIH, and that was one of my dreams, was to be a doctor at NIH, because to me, it's the pinnacle of brilliance and achievement and science. And so these doctors who work there are just the top, top doctors in their fields. And this one woman, I think her name is Dr. Goldbach. I forget her full name. She's actually the chief of infectious, I think, allergy and immunology. She's the chief of allergy and immunology at NIH. She was my friend's daughter's doctor.
And I'm sorry, Dr. Rafaela T. Goldbach-Mansky.
Yes. And so here she is, the chief of, you know, one of the most renowned medical institutions in the world. And she sat so close to my friend's daughter. And she was holding her hand while she was talking to her. And she treated my friend's daughter like she was just, that was all there was in the world, was her in that moment. And I thought, that's who I want to be. I want to be that, you know, that the brilliance and the intellect, and then to be so present and so kind at the same time.
It's so beautiful. It really is. I love that. What else would you say are formative experiences?
So my mom is crazy for cats. So we always had a lot of cats when we were little. And my mom, like if the cats would get hurt, I have these memories as a child where the cat's hurt. You can't approach a cat that's hurt. They'll just run away from you. Even if it's your pet, they're in pain and they don't know enough to say, oh yes, I'll go to the doctor. And my mom would have this whole system and this whole approach that was calculated and determined. And she was absolutely calm. And she always got the cat. And she would wrap them up in a towel so they wouldn't scratch her. And she would get them to the vet. And I loved that. I loved how, because you are so intensely empathetic and you want to help so, so much, you simultaneously cut off how you feel and do the action that needs to be done in a very steady, strong, kind of like ice cold, like this is happening.
Detached. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love how the passion, and I had this with the family that I was taking care of right before medical school, where I didn't do the research, that was very, very, very intense. I was like a machine, like going all day, taking care of things. And then Saturday night, I wasn't involved at Saturday nights. I would just get in bed and cry for 3 hours. But every other minute of every other day, I was going, and I was, because they needed.
By the way, this is what residency is like.
So I think I'll be good. I'm hoping I'll be good at it.
You're ready.
It's going to be grueling.
Yes, you should have confidence, because so many of your experiences were preparing you just for this moment.
I mean.
Yeah. So I really do believe that. Why did you pick family medicine?
So at first, I thought being in the hospital and emergency and surgery, I thought it was more exciting. But I can't stand not having relationships with my patients. I thought, I have so many friends. I have children. I have a grandson, hopefully more grandkids. I want to be able to focus on my relationships outside. So I should do something that's very chick-chock. But then I realized when I do things that are chick-chock, I just feel like I don't care.
Right. You didn't get this far to not do the type of medicine you want. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you didn't get this far to do the kind of medicine you didn't want to do.
Yeah, I get excited and motivated when I have relationships.
Oh, you're perfect for family medicine. I got to have you talk to some people. I have people in mind for you. Just have to get this, apparently this green minivan or whatever. There's a certain kind of car and a certain kind of shoe, and then you're ready for family medicine. So I think you're going to be amazing. I wrote a line here that, you know, you may not be able to have it all at once, but sequentially, you know, you may be able to have a lot of things. And so I'm really excited for you and for your next phase.
Yes, me too, because when I was preparing for interviews, my friend asked me, what are you most proud of? And I was most proud that I'd never sacrificed my kids during this process. And that I didn't excel in medical school the way I thought that I would or the way I wanted to, but I didn't sacrifice my children.
That's why this is called family first.
Yeah. Well, for me, that was, I don't want it to sound like I'm criticizing other people.
No.
You know, I'm encouraging my daughters to be career focused and somehow figure it out as they go along. I don't want to sound like I'm telling other people that they should do. I'm not saying people should give up their careers.
No.
Just that for me, it was what I did and I feel good about it right now.
You should, because you prioritize the right thing at the right time. Everything you're talking about your whole life has always been putting what's on the front burner, what belongs on the front burner. Right?
Yeah.
And so I give you a lot of credit because you have accomplished so much and yet you're still able to have that dream that you nurtured all along come true.
Well, I'm excited for residency because in residency, I can't put my family first. And it doesn't matter what's going on at home. And I will have to be doing medicine first. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually excited because that was what I thought medical school would be like. Mm. And it was never that way. And I'm excited to just have to do medicine. Mm-hmm. And everybody's older, you know, they'll be fine.
Right. You're pushing it to the front burner because it's time.
Yeah. They'll be fine, God willing. And it's a finite period in time.
Right. Right. And you'll pull your team, your family team together for you. So you can keep that medicine pot boiling up front, right?
Right.
So I want to give you the bracha that you should be successful in all that you do. And I really have to put a note on my phone to call you on May 13th to call you doctor, to be one of the first people to give you that well-deserved doctor.
You're so sweet. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this with me and have a good Shabbos.
Have a good
Shabbos. I know it's Wednesday, but it's always almost Shabbos for me.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to you. This has been a very powerful hour.
Oh, I'm so glad. And I'm sure it's going to be helpful for other people too. It's really inspiring for me.
Thank you so much.
Be well.
Hatzlacha.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org. That's JOMA.org. Or email us at health@joma.org.